Christmas。
各位。
The 12th me.
第九届土著居民的常设论坛的第十二次会议现在开始。尊敬的各位常设代表成员们，根据我们的今天的工作的安排啊，我们将继续的来审议第七议程项目。这是常设论坛的今后的工作，其中包括经济和社会事务部的有关的一些问题。我们要审议以下的一些报告，关于土著居民的这个报告。初步的来审议土著居民来在
which has served as the foundation of the violation of their human rights. Consideration of issues relating to Beijing 50+15. In addition, the permanent forum will hear comments from the speakers on all studies and reports listed under item 7 of the agenda in the program of work E/C.19/2010/L. Thus, time permitting, the opportunity to make a statement will be given to those speakers who were not given the floor on the agenda item under consideration earlier this week. I would like to give the floor now to Mr. Willie Littlechild.
Yeah, he has the floor.
You have the floor.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, and good morning to all delegations. With your permission, sir, I would like to address all of the reports in one statement, so we only take the floor once, and also ask your permission to present Chief Guy Lonechild's intervention, because he had to leave emergency wise this morning. He was here all week, but he didn't get on. So with your permission, I'd like to give a brief statement, and all of these will be submitted as written statements. First of all, with your permission, we'd like to table our written intervention on item 4B that was discussed earlier and address item 7. We'd like to thank you, Mr. Chair, and your colleagues and the Secretariat, because we want to restate how outstanding last week was because of your successful efforts to respect time. We will make highlight comments only and submit our written text. Our delegation once again thanks and honors the traditional caretakers of these territories, the Haudenosaunee. We appreciate the work of the Secretariat and all the permanent forum Special Rapporteur's reports presented under this agenda regarding climate change and the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, and the study on the Indigenous Peoples and Corporations in particular. On climate change and the UN Declaration, which you, Mr. Chair, and our esteemed Rapporteur presented, we would like to add that treaties and treaty principles can be a part of the solution in addressing climate change. Honoring and implementing treaties, agreements, and other constructive arrangements within the context of the UN Declaration offers a legal and political framework for partnerships, better relationships, and the management and preservation of natural resources and the environment. The study recognized this important perspective, Mr. Chair, in your report in paragraph 40. We support the conclusion of the Secretariat with respect to the engagement, participation, and the free, prior, and informed consent of Indigenous peoples, which referenced in particular rights under treaty, agreement and other constructive arrangements in paragraph 80. We also support gender equality with respect to climate change and recognize the important roles to be played by Indigenous women regarding climate change negotiations, processes, or related international initiatives. We endorse the conclusions and recommendations of the results of the Copenhagen meeting of the Conference of the Parties to the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, implications for Indigenous peoples and local adaptation and mitigation measures, as reported by Special Rapporteurs Victoria Tauli-Corpus and Lars Anders Baer. On a personal note, I want to thank them for their very important contributions at Copenhagen. On Indigenous Peoples and Corporations, by our brother Pavel, we endorse the proposed draft outline of the study on Indigenous Peoples and Corporations, in particular, Section 6. We also support the inclusion of a code of ethics for corporations who fall under the mandate of the proposed work. Our delegation looks forward to contributing to the work of the Special Rapporteurs in their continuing efforts in this regard. We request a permanent forum to continue to encourage the promotion and respect for Indigenous peoples' rights under treaty, agreements, and other constructive arrangements with regard to climate change impacts, adaptation and mitigation, and the protection of the rights of Mother Earth. I would add, Mr. Chair, that there's also a very significant treaty right to fishing, which is also one of the reports that was tabled. With your permission, I also want to table Chief Guy Lonechild's intervention. As I indicated, he had to leave on an emergency basis. I am here on behalf of the Federation of Saskatchewan Indian Nations, representing 5 treaty territories comprised of 74 autonomous First Nations. Our mandate is to protect, promote, and implement the treaties made between our nations and the British Crown more than a century ago. Today, I address the question of the doctrine of discovery and the effect it has had on our treaties. And I offer some thoughts on how we might conceive a new doctrine to replace it, a doctrine that accords with emerging international standards and also with some recent developments in Canadian constitutional law. Our ultimate aim is to secure recognition, respect, and protection for our treaties. First, let me say this. The doctrine of discovery is a misunderstanding. It's a mistake. It is evident from the short preliminary study that has been done by the Forum that this doctrine cannot serve the interests of Indigenous peoples, nor the interests of states, nor the promotion of the most fundamental standards of international law or public morality. The doctrine of discovery was essentially a statement of agreement between a few European imperial states. The doctrine was later interpreted to mean that imperial powers and their successor states held absolute sovereign authority over our peoples and territories and lands, and domestic courts were not about to upset that relationship. It prompted them to unjustly apply the doctrine to legal questions about the nature of the relationship between our peoples and the new governments of these states that assumed control and authority over our lands. This has had, as you heard, Mr. Chairman, disastrous effects upon our relationship and also upon present prospects for creating new and better relations. The doctrine allowed Canadian courts, for example, to decide that our treaties did not have any binding legal force, notwithstanding the acknowledged force of the maxims that promises must be kept and pacta sunt servanda. Domestic courts were able to decide that treaty promises did not matter. New ideas began to emerge in Canadian judicial thought after the Constitution was amended in 1982 to recognize and affirm our treaty rights. This development coincided with the work of the United Nations in developing standards, works which resulted in the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. It's this new era that we find inspiration for a new doctrine. The UN Declaration declares our right to self-determination and our right of self-government and the duties of states to recognize and respect our treaties. The old unjust doctrine of discovery is indeed a mistake and misunderstanding. The new doctrine to replace it is the doctrine of reconciliation. The doctrine of reconciliation has political and legal as well as personal dimensions. The doctrine of reconciliation can guide representatives of governments and states to meet with indigenous peoples and in good faith discuss and negotiate arrangements for mutual recognition, mutual respect, and the promotion of our mutual interests on this small planet. We support the work of the Permanent Forum, its endeavors to find better ideas and methods whereby the United Nations can better serve the interests of humanity. Ecosse. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
شكرا ولي تشايلد على هذا التدخل.
Thank you for this intervention.
الآن أود أن أنتقل إلى اللائحة التي هي أمامي بالنسبة لل. أود بداية أن أنادي السيد لوري جونستون عن تجمع أمريكا الشمالية. Caucus, North American Caucus. Laurie Johnson.
Laurie Johnson has the floor.
Here in the room, no? You are not. Good. The next one on my list is Azur Peacock. Australia, Indigenous Peoples and Forests.
From Australian
Australian
Youth Caucus.
Australian Youth Caucus. You are here?
Yeah.
Good. You have the floor, please. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Catherine Stone and I'll be delivering this intervention. The Australian Youth Delegation would like to acknowledge and thank the Onondaga Nation, the traditional owners on the land of the land on which we meet today. We would also like to acknowledge and pay our respects to their ancestors. The Indigenous Australian Youth Delegation would like to acknowledge the Australian Government's recent commitment to improving the educational outcomes for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. As human rights are universal and indivisible, Indigenous young people should not be expected to forego their rights to self-determination and cultural identity in order to realise their basic right to a basic education. In many Indigenous Australian communities, to gain an education, young people are faced with the stark choice of either moving from their traditional lands to attend boarding schools or staying on their traditional lands in order to practice their culture without access to formal education. We believe that always as a first option, Indigenous young people should be able to access the highest standards of education where they live. We as the Youth Delegation believe that any form of education must incorporate our culture, our cultural responsibilities and unique identity as the oldest surviving culture in Australia. Whilst we acknowledge that some improvements have been made in the areas of education, there is an urgent need for improvements in the development and retention of a cultural education. There is also a pressing need for education providers to participate in mandatory cultural awareness training, as education is a social institution and has incredible power to act either as an agent of assimilation or affirmation of Indigenous identity. The Bringing Them Home report, commissioned by the Australian Government and compiled by the Australian Human Rights and Equal Opportunity Commission, as they were then known, now the Australian Human Rights Commission, illustrated and provided evidence of the damage and ongoing intergenerational trauma caused by assimilationist policies, including the removal of children from their families and denial of cultural practices. In 2008, the Australian government apologised to the stolen generations and pledged to learn from past mistakes of these policies. As such, current education policies should reflect this pledge and ensure education delivered to Indigenous Australians is grounded in personal development through culture and identity. In some instances, the provision of scholarships and incentives to Indigenous children and young people to attend schooling away from their traditional lands and communities are well-meaning yet misguided attempts to provide access to education. In this sense, children and young people often set up to fail in a new and overwhelming environment without foundational education and adequate academic, personal and pastoral support to thrive and make the most of their learning experiences. More often than not, education providers fail to provide an environment where our students can feel culturally secure and to be safe to learn as Indigenous young people. In document E/C.19/2010/11, there is evidence which demonstrates Indigenous Australian young people who are moved off of their country to attend schools are less likely to undertake post-secondary education, twice as likely to be arrested and convicted of an offence, and twice as likely to use intravenous drugs. Australian governments should ensure that schools, regardless of location, are resourced equitably. This would ensure that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander families, no matter where they live, have choices in schooling to maintain their cultural integrity. Our recommendation is that the Permanent Forum urge states to recognise and take into account the negative impact of policies of assimilation on the education of Indigenous youth in the formation of policies on Indigenous education. States must ensure that assimilation is a public policy is never repeated. We recommend the Permanent Forum urge states to ensure that educational policies are consistent with Article 14 of the Declaration, which emphasises the importance of education and culture to Indigenous peoples. We recommend the Permanent Forum urge states to distribute resources equitably to ensure that our people have access to education, regardless of location or the size of community. Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
I would like to call now Madame Celeste McKay from Native Women's Association of Canada, American Indian Law Alliance, North America, Children and the Earth. About Children and the Earth. That's good. Madame Celeste, you are in the room. You are here?
Please ask her to raise her hand if she's in the room. If not, move on to the speaker. Next speaker.
Then Madame Celeste is not here. The next one on my list is Andrea Carmen from International Indian Treaty Council, Seven Generations Fund Flying Eagle Woman, North America. You have the floor, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Danica Littlechild. I'll be presenting on behalf of Andrea. We take this opportunity to present the following recommendations on the future work of the Permanent Forum. We recommend that at future sessions, the Permanent Forum provide an opportunity for consideration of key cross-cutting issues that impact several areas of their mandate. I am reading for Andrea Carmen. She has left New York today. May I continue?
Good, you can.
The Permanent Forum's mandate is uniquely suited to this approach. Many issues impacting Indigenous peoples address more than one of the Permanent Forum's mandated themes. Cross-cutting issues could either be added as separate agenda item or could be included as a sub-theme under the implementation of the UN Declaration. A specific example, which we recommend as one of the Permanent Forum's two EGMs in the next year, is the links between reproductive and environmental health and justice, in particular for Indigenous women. This EGM would focus on the local and global impacts of environmental toxins, including pesticides, mercury, nuclear contamination, and mining runoffs, on the health of Indigenous women, infants, children, and the unborn. Indigenous women in highly contaminated areas experience reproductive system cancers, infertility, stillbirths, and birth defects. This is a critical issue which cuts across several of the mandated focus areas of the Permanent Forum, including health, environment, development, and human rights. This issue is also directly relevant to the Permanent Forum's longstanding commitment to the situations faced by Indigenous women, youth, and children. This EGM could serve as an opportunity and entry point for Indigenous experts, including traditional knowledge holders and health workers, to develop strategies, proposals, recommendations, and responses within the UN system. This EGM could begin to document situations and experiences in various regions and make recommendations for responses by the UN system, taking into account Articles 22, 23, 24, 29, and other relevant provisions of the UN Declaration. We endorse the proposal made by many participants that the Permanent Forum organize an expert group meeting on the doctrine of discovery to include consideration of its impacts on the enjoyment of rights affirmed in the UN Declaration. We also recommend that the Permanent Forum carry out a comprehensive study to follow up on the preliminary study of the doctrine of discovery presented at the ninth session. We endorse the recommendation by the expert group meeting on Indigenous children and youth in detention, custody, foster care, and adoption, supported by a number of NGOs as well as the Global Youth Caucus at the session, to organize and conduct a follow-up seminar to monitor the implementation of the recommendations of the 2010 EGM and document additional good practices, solutions, and lessons learned. Finally, we endorse the recommendation made by a number of Indigenous organizations as presented under Agenda Item 3 during the first week of this session as follows. We ask the Permanent Forum to take immediate action this year to establish water as a theme for its 10th session in 2011. This is a cross-cutting issue across all six of the Permanent Forum mandated areas. Finally, Mr. Chair, we welcome and endorse the recommendation presented by the members of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada, calling for the Permanent Forum to organize an international roundtable, or EGM, on truth commissions to continue discussing the impacts of residential schools and other child removal policies, as well as the work of the truth commissions in various parts of the world. Thank you for your consideration of these recommendations.
Thank you. I would like now to call Chantriya Tem Khmers Kampuchi Krom. You are here?
Yes, here.
Yeah, take the floor, please.
Thank you. I have to start. Yes. Mr. Chairman and distinguished members of the forum, we are saddened to hear about the common conditions Indigenous peoples face regarding boarding schools, yet we are here, we are pleased to participate in seeking solutions for a new future for our children. We recommend that Vietnam, one, ensures that the standards of these specialist boarding schools be equal to those of mainstream public schools, two, permits arts and literature to be taught in our languages to safeguard and protect our cultures, three, permits our histories to be taught in both mainstream public schools and boarding schools. Four, increases the number of places in all boarding schools and ensures unbiased geographical dispersion of new schools to ensure education for all is not a dream dependent on ethnic background. Mr. Chairman and distinguished members of the forum, we cannot change the past, but we can and most definitely should collaborate to work for a better future. We are the youth of the Khmer Krom people. We have great recommendations for the UNPFII, but a few key questions that we pose each and every year remain unanswered. We once again request clarification from the UNPFII in the hope that a heavy burden be lifted from our hearts. Still today, the Vietnamese government refuses to recognize us as Indigenous people of Vietnam. Are our temples in Prie Tha Pang, Klang, and Muat Truk, which are over 2,000 years old, many years older than the existence of Vietnam itself, not proof of a long-standing connection to our land? Is there a separate rule for Vietnam which states that our long history and distinct culture and tradition are worthless when designating Indigenous status? Unfortunately, this is the sixth year that we raise these concerns. We therefore recommend One, that the permanent forum set up a half-day discussion on mechanisms for the representation of unrecognized and marginalized peoples who are not respected by their governments. Two, that the permanent forum set up a commission on the definition of indigenous people, which then seeks an invitation from the Vietnamese government. Three, and that Vietnam accepts our request to have open and constructive dialogue with the Khmer Kampuchea Krom Federation and the Montagnol Foundation as proof of their commitment to protecting and promoting the rights of their peoples. We thank you, Mr. Chairman, for allowing us to voice our concerns and offer our recommendations. We hope that 2010 marks the year that fruitful collaboration commences so that we find ourselves in a different position at the historic 10th session next year. We have come here for the past 6 years to learn and try to understand ways to help our youth at home where they are silenced and living in fear due to the human rights violations. During this time, NGOs such as Human Rights Watch and governments recognize the human rights violations in international law. I humbly ask you again, if we are not here to represent our youth today at the UNPFII, who will? Vietnam has wanted to silence us. However, we sincerely will continue speaking the truth. It is sad and awkward that the Vietnamese government keeps on denying our very existence and trying to make us invisible. Yet we are invincible, just like our brothers and sisters here. Thank you.
Thank you. I would like to call... I would like now to call Omaro Hindu, Indigenous Peoples of Africa Coordination AFRAD. Hindu, you have the floor, please. You are not in the room.
Ask her to raise the hand if she's in.
Could you raise your hand, Hindu, Omaro? No, you are not here. Thank you. I would like now to call Monica Allman, International Indigenous Women's Forum.
This one spoke yesterday and they're not this African caucus. I wrote it on your
She's not here. Good. The next one on my list is Sergio Hinojosa, Consejo Nacional de Ailos y Marcas.
He spoke yesterday.
He had his floor yesterday. Next one is Carlos Eden Mile, International Native Tradition Interchange.
Not in the room. Actually, Lori Johnston is back in the room, but you can give her the floor.
Good. Lori Johnson. Yamasai people, Southeast North America. You are here? Good. You have the floor, please.
Thank you for allowing Southeast Indigenous peoples to participate in the permanent forum. Because this is currently the only opportunity for us to discuss issues affecting our peoples and work together with other Indigenous peoples to implement solutions, the permanent forum, the Haudenosaunee and Algonquin hosts are now part of our national histories. We thank you all and wish blessings on your peoples. We face difficulties functioning as autonomous Indigenous peoples and nations because the U.S. outlaws our self-determination. The U.S. occupies our land, commandeers our resources while attacking us physically, economically, militarily, socially, and politically. The U.S. will not talk with us about solutions to climate change problems that the U.S. created on our lands. U.S. corporations are encouraged by the U.S. to bulldoze our peoples, lands, and cultures, exacerbating climate change impacts while contributing to carbon emissions that cause climate change. We call on the Permanent Forum to include in the future work of the Forum ways that national state governments can work with Indigenous peoples and nations on climate change mitigation and relocation, especially of coastal peoples who are currently watching their ancestral lands disappear into the ocean. The Permanent Forum study on climate change policies will be relevant to the world if it consults with Indigenous peoples of the southeast of North America. Indigenous economies are dependent on our Indigenous vocations of gathering, hunting, fishing, farming, healing, and art. We cannot produce our former wealth in these vocations because our winds, waters, and lands have been poisoned by U.S. development that excludes southeast peoples. The U.S. refuses to respond to our requests for dialogue and information about our waters, which sustain our economy, society, culture, and spirituality. The U.S. denies us the right to free, prior, and informed consent because it does not communicate with us, much less talk with us or listen to us regarding development impacting indigenous lands. We call on the Permanent Forum to explore ways the forum can facilitate safe, ongoing, productive dialogue between indigenous peoples and the nation states occupying our lands, perhaps in relation to climate change policies. Because the U.S. occupies indigenous lands, we are hindered in our economic, social, and cultural development, and our safety is threatened. Because the U.S. and other nation states occupy indigenous lands and want us to disappear, these nations attack us violently. We call on the Permanent Forum to include in its future work the corporate causes of physical, environmental, health, political, and cultural impacts of wars of aggression against indigenous peoples, especially women and children. Thank you.
Thank you. I would like to call now Daniel Gabriel, Syrian Universal Alliance. He is not in the room.
So, Elverina.
The next one on my list is Elverina Johnson, National Aboriginal Community Control Health Organization from Australia.
Yeah.
You have the floor, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I stand before you today as a proud Aboriginal woman and a member of the Indigenous Peoples Organisation of Australia, represented at this Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues. I present this intervention on behalf of Indigenous women in Australia to highlight the concerns that continue to adversely impact on our emotional and social well-being. The Beijing Platform for Action recognises that women face barriers to full equity and advancement because of such factors as poverty, health, violence, and human rights. It could be said that women from all cultural and social backgrounds share similar experiences that pertain to a history of gender inequality and cultural discrimination. And this is also the case for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women across Australia. The experience of Indigenous women in Australia are compounded by a history of social and cultural disempowerment, marginalisation, and oppression as a result of the colonial manifestations that are yet to be addressed. I now take this opportunity to report on a number of specific examples of barriers and social concerns. The recent removal of this community development and employment program has created immense stress and depression amongst our communities and has hampered any improvement to the unemployment rates of Indigenous people and contributed to the ongoing social and financial impoverishments of our families, particularly the women and children. The alcohol reform strategies engaged by government together with the alcohol management plan designed to purportedly to address the impact of alcohol-related offences in Indigenous communities has done little to quell the level of violence and violence-related offences said to be associated with the alcohol consumption within Indigenous communities. Government have readily implemented punitive strategies to address alcohol-related offences with little, if any, attention having been given to the establishment of policies and the development of services designed to offer much-needed rehabilitation and detoxification programs in our communities. The income management component of welfare reform in Far North Queensland, Australia, is known as the Family Income Management Scheme. This scheme has brought scorn upon the Australian government to not only from within our communities, but also from representatives associated with the United Nations and other global entities. We, the Indigenous people organisations represented here at this forum, recommend that the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues strongly encourage Indigenous women to be active and prominent in the identification and resolution of key issues of concern associated with the human rights and development of Indigenous people. The United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues call upon the Indigenous women to be equally represented.
Thank you. We'll submit our recommendations.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I would like to call now Mohamed Handain, Confédération des Associations Amazigh Sud Maroc. You have the floor.
Where is that?
Merci, Monsieur.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On behalf of the Amazigh delegation, which includes several indigenous delegations of Africa, South Africa, and the diaspora, we commend the work made by the experts as represented in this report, which has been submitted on the situation of indigenous peoples in the various fields of endeavor. Indigenous peoples as they are affected by the phenomena of globalization and climate change. Mr. Chairman, these transformations and changes that indigenous peoples have experienced have completely changed their lives radically, that they have changed that they've never experienced in their history. Civilization, languages, even the existence of these indigenous peoples is now in question. In our region, the situation of Imazir is very dire, and we ask the governments of the region to engage in a responsible dialogue in order to avoid political excesses that could threaten stability and peace in the region. Now, in the face of this situation, Mr. Chairman, the delegation, the Amazigh delegation, recommends, firstly, to encourage the states of the region to begin an immediate implementation of the declaration in order to resolve the critical situation of the Amazigh people. Two, request the states to receive the special rapporteur of the UN on indigenous peoples. Three, demand international courts to judge those who are guilty of the crimes of climate change that threaten the existence of our people. Four, encourage member states to elaborate national laws that are that comply with international standards. And finally, request permanent authorities to intervene as intermediates between indigenous peoples and governments in emergency situations in order to preserve the peace and the survival of indigenous peoples. Thank you very much.
Merci beaucoup.
Thank you.
Now to call Madame Leet Pete Oxfam from Australia. You are not in the room? Next.
Okay.
You are there? Ah, good. You have the floor, please.
Hello, Tammy Solonek from Australia. I'm talking on behalf of Leah Pitt.
Take your earphones off. Speak up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. This intervention on the doctrine of discovery is delivered on behalf of the Indigenous Peoples Organisations of Australia present at this forum. The doctrine of discovery has a shameful history in international law and in the domestic law of the United States. The doctrine is akin to the doctrine of terra nullius applied in Australia. Both have a history of entrenched racism. The doctrines have been used to rationalise and the dispossession of Indigenous peoples from their lands and waters and to justify non-recognition of their political sovereignty. This has resulted in a disgraceful history of dispossession, degradation and genocide. The doctrine of discovery was first adopted into US law in 1823 to justify the taking of Indian lands in the US Supreme Court case of Johnson and McIntosh, where it was observed that Christian European nations had assumed ultimate dominion over the lands of America during the Age of Discovery. Under the doctrine, the Indians lost their right to complete sovereignty as independent nations and only retained a right of occupancy in their lands. In Australia, a similar story played out with the doctrine of terra nullius, which is Latin for land belonging to no one. Some say that rather than terra nullius meaning vacant or empty land, which it clearly was not, that it was interpreted as being an absence of civilised society. The first Australian mention of the doctrine of terra nullius was in 1835, when the New South Wales governor implemented the doctrine and proclaimed that Aboriginal peoples could not sell, assign or acquire land other than through distribution by the Crown. Although this explicit use of the term was used this early on in British settlement to refuse Aboriginal ownership of land and to continue taking land, it was not endorsed by the Privy Council in England until 1889 in Cooper and Stewart. The main difference between the doctrine of terra nullius as it was used in Australia and the doctrine of discovery as used in the US was religion. In US, the term unoccupied lands was used to refer to the lands in America which, when discovered, were occupied by Indians but unoccupied by Christians. The Indians were considered heathens because they lacked Christianity. In Australia, it wasn't that the Aboriginal peoples were considered lesser humans because they lacked Christianity, it was that they were not considered human at all. In Australia, Aboriginal peoples were provided for under state flora and fauna legislation without being referred to as human. Regardless of the justification, the doctrines had the same result, which was to significantly reduce the ability of Indigenous peoples to own their land or acquire other land. This is recent history for Australia, with the doctrine only being repudiated by the Australian High Court in 1992 in the famous Mabo decision. Like the doctrine of discovery, the legacy of the legal fiction of terra nullius lives on. In Australia today, we see Aboriginal peoples with epidemically low levels of freehold ownership and complicated and watered-down native title rights. In that regard, we recommend that the Permanent Forum conduct and coordinate a comprehensive review of the doctrines of discovery and terra nullius and other similar doctrines around the world that have been used as a legal basis to dispossess Indigenous peoples of their lands. We further recommend that the study consider current laws which perpetuate the doctrines, such as the law of inheritance, and make recommendations as to how their impact may be unravelled, including through compensation and reparation schemes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. I would like now to give the floor to Madame Christiana Loa, Landlife. Madame Christiana, you have the floor.
I'm here, sir.
You can start.
My name is Christiana Saiti Loa. I'm reading a statement on behalf of the Elmolo people and the Elmolo Forum, which is also a member of Land is Life Network. The statement is on agenda number 5, the study to determine whether climate change policies and projects adhere to standards in the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. Climate change continues to affect the Elmolo people and other Indigenous peoples living around Lake Turkana, bordering Ethiopia and Sudan. Mr. Chair, the Elmolo people, being a minority and the smallest tribe in Kenya, are on the verge of extinction, and the construction of the Gibe Dam 3 in Ethiopia will definitely contribute to this phenomenon, amongst other factors such as climate change. For us, the Gibe 3 project on the Omo River is a rights issue, as there was no free, prior, and informed consent with the 500,000 indigenous peoples living downstream, like the Mursi, Nyangatom, and around Lake Turkana, for people like the Elmolo, the Turkana, the Dasenach, the Samburu, and the Rendile, the Gabras. The Omo River is the only major inlet that drains into Lake Turkana. The Ethiopian government is undertaking an ambitious program to divert the Omo River waters into Gibe Dam 3 for production of hydroelectric, a project that is said to cost about £1.2 billion. Diverting or blocking of the Omo waters from draining into Lake Turkana will increase the salt levels in the lake. This, ladies and gentlemen, will mean death, in that the lake's ecosystem will be completely destroyed as there will be no life in the lake. The lake will no longer sustain life as it will be unfit for fish and human and livestock consumption. Here, we are looking at the possible demise in the long run of lives and livelihoods of more than 500,000 indigenous peoples. Mr. Chairman, this will also bring about a situation of internally displaced peoples, as well as international refugees. The construction and use of the Gibe III Dam will escalate conflicts in an already volatile region and add to this, and due to the scramble and competition for scarce resources, as well as the region having plenty of military hardware to cause war amongst indigenous peoples. The environmental and social impact assessment for this ambitious project was only carried out on the Ethiopian side, but not on the Kenyan side. The government of Kenya and Ethiopia are said to have signed a memorandum of understanding where the Kenyan government will purchase power from Ethiopia upon completion of this project. The Gibe III project is an international issue. The governments involved are Ethiopia, because the dam is constructed on their soil, Kenya, and also Italy, as the Salini construction is an Italian company. Our recommendations, therefore, are we therefore strongly demand a bold and honest statement from the Kenyan government on its position on the Gibe III project, that the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples is entrenched into the new Kenyan draft constitution, currently being debated as there is no mention of indigenous rights in it so far. That the international community intervene and put more pressure for this project to be discontinued to save lives of half a million people and indigenous people. Indigenous people to be involved and consulted at all levels of decision making on matters affecting them. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Madam Christina. I would like to call Craig Cromlin, New South Wales Aboriginal Land Council from Australia. Yeah, you have the floor, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I present this one on behalf of my chairperson, Ms. Bev Manton, who's currently on her way to the airport to fly back to Australia. The New South Wales Aboriginal Land Council is pleased to make this intervention on behalf of representatives of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander organisations present at this forum. In particular, I am pleased to report on considerable improvements in the position of Aboriginal cultural fishers in the state of New South Wales, Australia. The Australian Aboriginal culture is one of the world's longest surviving continuous cultures. Our culture has been maintained through the continual practice of traditions and the transfer of knowledge from generation to generation. An important part of Aboriginal culture is the practice of fishing, both of subsistence means and ceremonial purpose. Aboriginal people have a spiritual, social, customary association with fishing resources. Fishing has provided a major component of customary diet, and it has been readily available to tribes situated both on the coast and inland. This subsistence lifestyle included a hierarchy of resource distribution provided communally for elders, women, infants, youth, and women and men. In addition to the day-to-day practice of fishing as a subsistence measure, fishing has also provided feasts for cultural ceremonies. As outlined in the report on Indigenous fishing rights in the seas, with case studies from Australia and Norway prepared for the permanent forum by Australian Professor Mr. Mick Dodson and Carsten Smith, there is no comprehensive recognition of Aboriginal fishing rights across Australia. While national native title legislation offers some avenues for recognition to date, there is no Australia-wide acknowledgement of these rights and practices, and where some recognition has been forthcoming, it has been limited and confined not to interfere with the rights and interests of other Australians. In short, both management of fishing resources and the recognition of Aboriginal cultural practices are managed largely through state and territory governments. Some states, however, have acknowledged that Aboriginal cultural connection to the fisheries resources in their respective legislation and have included provisions for this within the fisheries management regimes. Three examples of such legislation exist in Northern Territory, Tasmania and Western Australia. In the Northern Territory, cultural fishing has been recognised and provided freedoms to continue without concessions, provided that the cultural fisher does not interfere with another party's catch or equipment. Tasmania has also afforded some similar protections to the Aboriginal cultural fisher through the Living Marine Resources Management Act 1995 in Tasmania, which provides an exemption for Aboriginal fishers from requiring a fishing licence when engaging in an Aboriginal activity. The West Australian Government, in its Aboriginal Fishing Strategy 2003, recognised that sharing of fish is important socially and communally. Sharing often extends to barter and exchange of fish for other items such as other food sources within Aboriginal communities. Nonetheless, and despite this, there has not been a national coordinated and concerted effort to address the resource rights of Australia's Indigenous peoples to the seas and rivers, including proper recognition and acknowledgement of continuing fishing practices. In my home state of New South Wales, like so many other states and territories in Australia, the management and recognition of fisheries resources have impacted on the availability of fresh and saltwater resources for Aboriginal fishers and have consequently hindered the maintenance of traditional practice. Indeed, in the more recent past, Aboriginal communities in New South Wales have wanted to undertake traditional fishing, found themselves overburdened with detailed administrative processes and limited to the same catch limits as non-Aboriginal recreational fishers. Right, on to the recommendations, Mr. Chair. Recommendation that the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Peoples calls upon all states to formally implement and give proper meaning to the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, and two, that the Permanent Forum on Indigenous People strongly urges the Australian Government to establish and implement a national human rights framework which specifically recognises the unique status of Australia's Indigenous peoples and provides means by which to further strengthen our Aboriginal cultural institutions in Australia, including cultural fishing. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I would like now to call Omaro Hindu, Indigenous Peoples of African Coordination, AFRAT.
African Caucus.
African Caucus.
Yes.
Not this. Indigenous Peoples of African Caucus. You have the floor, Omar. Omaro Hindu.
That's how they want to be called. She forgot
to go to the room. De la chasse, cueillette, élevage et la.
Cattle herding and subsistence agriculture. And they find themselves in arid, semi-arid, and tropical areas where their pastures and forests are. The Indigenous peoples of Africa know no other life than the life tied to natural resources in the places where they live in full harmony with the ecosystem, allowing it to regenerate by itself. But at present, and for the last 10 years, seasons have changed. There are higher temperatures, there are stronger winds, and they all have negative impacts on pasture lands, vegetation, flora, and fauna. There are floods in certain areas, droughts in other areas, and this produces food instability. They have tried to adapt once again, but this time it is not the same situation because the animals are either dying or sold. The resources are exhausted by exploitation industries or by powerful individuals. That is complicated by the occupation of lands. They have tried to do subsistence agriculture, but they do not manage to have harvests allowing them to live because they don't have their own lands and they don't have the techniques. That is complicated by problems that already existed, such as marginalization and discrimination in the social, economic, and political area. The life of the autochthonous peoples in Africa has become more vulnerable and even critical because of climate change. The national programs for adaptation to climate change do not necessarily involve the indigenous peoples, despite their traditional knowledge of management of nature and biodiversity. But we are participating in these international fora to recover our right to participate at the national level. The negotiation fora at the national level are limited by lack of representation of our peoples in the great government institutions such as the parliaments. The solutions might be fostered by the permanent forum. We call upon the permanent forum to help us increase the number of studies in this area so as to be able to create awareness of our vulnerability and find a solution together with us. There must be special attention for the implementation of adaptation projects based on our traditional knowledge of adaptation and management of the environment and in line with the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. Thank you very much, sir. Thank you, Madam Hindu Amaru Ibrahim. Now I'm going to give the floor to Mr. Brian Ryatt, National Native Title Council.
You have the floor, please, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is a joint intervention delivered by me on behalf of the Indigenous Peoples Network of Australia. The Australian Native Title Act was proclaimed in 1993 following the Mabo decision in the High Court of Australia. After 16 years of operation, the process for traditional owners to prove connection to country remains one of the major hardships for Indigenous communities. Native Title representative bodies in Australia have been pushing for amendments to the Native Title Act that will relieve the crushing burden of proof that is required under the Act. Many Native Title practitioners in Australia are also calling for changes to the system, including our Chief Justice, the highest office in Australia's judicial system. In fact, that same Chief Justice recently likened the Native Title processes to that of Sisyphus, a Greek god, doomed eternally to roll a large rock to the top of a hill, only to have it roll back down again. We continue to call on the State of Australia to change the Native Title Act so that some elements of the burden of proof are lifted from traditional owners and their families. This could be satisfied by introducing a rebuttal presumption of continuity, reversing the onus of proof so that the state or other respondent parties to a claim bears the burden of rebutting such a presumption. Given that in many instances, particularly in remote locations, there is little foundation for significant dispute over native title applicants' continuous connection to their traditional lands, the adoption of a rebuttal presumption should help reduce the resource burden on the native title system, helping facilitate the expeditious resolution of native title claims. Moreover, by reversing the onus of proof, the evidential burden is placed more appropriately on the state, which, by virtue of its corporate memory, is in a better position to elucidate on how it colonised or asserted its sovereignty over a claim area. This has the additional benefit of placing responsibility for investigating connection and extinguishment in the lap of the one entity, potentially leading to a more comprehensive understanding of the evidence in a given case. Importantly, the burden placed on the state by virtue of such a presumption may also result in positive behavioural changes, with the state having little incentive to expend resources in difficult disputes over continuity and connection, or to assert, for example, that continuity had effectively been broken because of actions that in our modern human rights climate would be considered abhorrent, for example, genocide or other breaches of international human rights law. In this respect, the introduction of a rebuttal presumption may act as a significant catalyst for a change, facilitating a shift in the way negotiations are conducted in the quality and quantity of positive outcomes for claimants. Mr. Chair, From the perspective of traditional owners, the experience of trying to prove their continuous connection to traditional lands directly affects their identity as Indigenous peoples, with the constant threat of being denied their individual history. After over 200 years...
Excuse me, could you please give your recommendations to the Secretariat if it is
necessary? Yes, Mr. Chair, I will do that.
Yeah.
It is a travesty that
Thank
our political
you.
System...
Thank you very much.
The Pivotic Forum seeks...
Now, I would like to call... Liz Maltzer. Liz Maltzer? Liz Maltzer. You are Liz Maltzer? Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is David Lee and I speak on behalf of Les Mauser and the Indigenous Peoples Organisations of Australia. We have seen the fallout of the global financial crisis around the world. Thankfully, Australia appears to have been spared the worst of it. However, we should take lessons from what occurred in 2008. Traditional owners in Australia, particularly those who have entered into negotiated agreements with extractive industries, were left exposed to losing significant economic benefits as well as their traditional rights to land. Through agreements with major resource companies, many traditional owners trade their native title rights in exchange for local employment, training and business opportunities, and resource companies have access to land. This has become best practice and Indigenous peoples are gaining benefits from Australia's resource boom. During the economic downturn, however, some of these companies had to scale back or in some instances defer the commencement of their projects. The recent economic downturn has reminded Indigenous peoples that agreements negotiated in good faith are vulnerable to fluctuations in the global financial market and they are therefore at risk of losing opportunities to participate fully in the economy. Australia's Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples cannot afford to lose their traditional rights to land for no determinable benefit. What we need to ensure in this economic turbulence is that states do not put in place regulatory mechanisms that will be detrimental to Indigenous peoples' capacity to negotiate economic opportunity. In the Kimberley region of Australia, the development of an industrial hub for the processing of liquefied natural gas is currently being negotiated. This includes the agreement of local traditional owners over native title rights and interest to the site, which includes the opportunity to provide significant financial benefits to local Indigenous communities. However, the government's determination to ensure its economic growth in order to protect against any possible future financial crisis may force the state to introduce regulatory schemes that could reduce the participation of Indigenous peoples. Under Article 3, the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples protects the rights of Indigenous peoples to freely pursue their economic, social and cultural development. This needs to be recognised and upheld. It is imperative that traditional peoples have full recognition of their cultural rights on land, participate fully and effectively in decision-making and consultation processes, and have free, prior and informed consent for projects. Therefore, Mr. Chair, we recommend that the Permanent Forum urges states to ensure that the rights of Indigenous peoples to freely pursue their economic, social and cultural development is protected, and also that the Permanent Forum urges states to increase the participation of Indigenous peoples in pursuing economic opportunity. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I would like now to call Madame Hélène Gabriel, les femmes autochtones du Québec, Canada. She is not in the room.
Statements at the meeting, this is from the interpreters, are too fast to interpret properly.
That's good.
Can you say that?
Next one on my list is Neil Gillespie, Aboriginal Legal Rights Movement, Australia. He is not in the room. Good. Next one is Gary Thomas, National Indigenous Higher Education Network, Australia. He's not in the room. Next one on my list is Mikhail Sinider, Office of the Israel Constitutional Law. Yeah, you have the floor.
Yeah. People have resided within the Holy Land continuously for 3,780 years. Following World War I and the gracious gifts of the victorious Allied nations, the lands of the Ottoman Empire and the Central Powers were divided up and promised to the indigenous people of the Middle East, Africa, and elsewhere. Within the Middle East and North Africa were created what are today 31 Arab or Islamic states, one Christian state, Lebanon, one Jewish state. With this promise achieved by unanimous vote, the League of Nations, the existing Jewish tribal organizations in the Holy Land made preparations for the influx of returning tribal members then residing outside the Holy Land. The current disputes between Jewish tribal and Arab peoples evaporate when viewed within the historical context of the time and are legally untenable under the provisions of the Mandate for Palestine and the Anglo-American Treaty of 1924, which, by the way, guaranteed the exclusive rights of Jewish settlement anywhere within the Holy Land. In April 1920, the Boundary Convention was completed by the League of Nations by a unanimous decision returning 70% of the Jewish tribal lands to the tribes for the creation of the Jewish national home. Subsequently, in violation of Article Number 6 of the mandate, the British government confiscated 78% of the mandated Jewish tribal lands and created Transjordan. Today, we have less than 12% of the land promised by the League of Nations, a mandate carried forward into the United Nations protocols. In 2006, Sharon expelled tribal members from what the modern world calls Gaza, and we lost most of the tribal lands of Dan and early Gad. I happen to be from the tribe of Asher. Those that were expelled still lack jobs and permanently homes. More recently, Jewish tribal members were expelled from other tribal lands to include Amona and 17 other settlement lands where they have lived for over 1,000 years. Today, we face new dangers as military governors close areas in advance of expulsions. To silence the opposition, legislation known as the incitement laws have been passed. Some people have already warned me I may be arrested when I return. We take these threats seriously, but we do have positive events. And we came to this meeting today and for this last 2 weeks with some gifts of our own in a program that we call Tribe to Tribe. I've heard so much about the loss of forest and about clean water. Since 1948, Israel has absorbed 3 million tribal members. And as a result of this, we've been replanting our forest. Since 1901, the Jewish National Fund has planted 240 million trees on Jewish tribal lands. The Jewish National Home is the only country in the world where more trees grow now than they did 100 years ago. The Jewish National Fund supports research studies on forestation and ecology. We've been transmitting that to other tribal groups for the last 8 years. I hope that as a result of this particular conference, we'll be able to offer training to all the Jewish tribal groups that have concerns about forestation, and we can even provide them with the seeds. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Thank you. I would like now to give the floor to Monsieur Luis Chavez Aquino, Union Nacional de Traductores Indígena, México. He's not in the floor?
Si.
In the room? You have the floor, please.
En el marco de la novena sesión.
In the framework of this session of the Permanent Forum, we respectfully address the chairman and the members of the forum, as well as all delegates and representatives of indigenous peoples and organizations of the world. To you goes our fraternal greeting from all who belong to the National Union of Indigenous Translators of Mexico, whose initials in Spanish are UNTI. In recent years, we have witnessed important progress in our country regarding the indigenous peoples. A number of government institutions and other civil population institutions have made important efforts to advance a development and recognition of the indigenous peoples. Our organization has also worked tirelessly for more than 25 years for the preservation, recognition, and development of indigenous languages and cultures. Mexico was one of the first countries that adopted the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, UNDRIP. But we see that dissemination efforts have been insufficient to create awareness among the population of the indigenous population. And as a result, the rights of indigenous persons continue to be violated in the areas of education, labor, religion, and a range of daily life experiences. For these reasons, we have presented to our government and to the Permanent Forum for Indigenous Questions the following suggestions. Development of workshops in the communities to explain the contents of the Declaration of Indigenous Peoples' Rights, with special emphasis on the articles relevant to individual and collective human rights, and urging the authorities and the indigenous population in general to respect them. These workshops and the materials to be used should appear in a bilingual format, that is, in Spanish and in the language of each community or region. That this very same training be made a part of the indigenous education programs. As an organization, we have voluntarily contributed to the distribution of the UNDRIP. We have also participated in the translation of that declaration. Today, we reiterate our readiness to continue working for the benefit of our indigenous peoples, cultures, and languages. Thank you very much, sir. Thank you very much.
Kol o sebeyo chuktaya hanko, coordinadora nacional de asociaciones cristianas indígena del Perú. Yeah, you have the floor, please.
Perú. Señor Presidente, la novena sesión.
Mr. Chairman, this session of the forum, respected members of the forum, representatives of governments, brothers and sisters of indigenous peoples of the world, I am Eusebio Juktai Anko, and I speak in representation of the National Coordinator of Christian Indigenous Associations of Peru. As a national organization, we work in the different regions and among different language communities, for the preservation and promotion of the original languages, for teaching of reading and writing, and the rescue of values that will be conducive to life in harmony with our Creator and our environment. In the Republic of Peru, we have found it to be necessary to have greater representation of indigenous peoples in higher levels of government, in decision-making areas, and in the political and social affairs of the country. Based on that observation, and with all due respect, we suggest the following, hoping that through this forum, the adequate instruments be made to reach the Peruvian government. First, that the indigenous people's affairs have a ministerial level and that it maintain a continuous dialogue with the indigenous people seeking national peace instead of persecuting its leaders. Second, that the voice of the indigenous peoples must be heard by the legislature. So, for which we suggest implementation of an indigenous parliament freely and democratically elected. Third, and that the Ministry of Education and Culture assign a greater budget and work to implement the indigenous education programs in order to preserve and promote the different languages and their variants which are a right of their cultural identity. 4, that the government consult the indigenous peoples on the use of their forestry and land resources before making deals with companies. 5, that a indigenous peoples fund be created to promote agriculture beyond the subsistence stage. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you very much. I would like now to call Tenkishwa Rabha Indian Confederation of Indigenous and Tribal Peoples Northeast Zone, India, from India. Yeah, you have the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I bring cordial greetings to all of you from Rabha and other indigenous people of Assam, India. In order to improve the future work of United Nations promotion of indigenous issues, we would like to recommend the following recommendations. Number one, to ensure the government of India to respect and implement the United Nations Declaration of Rights for Indigenous Issues and to record granting sexual status to Rabha Assam Tribal Council of the Indian Constitution. Number two, to ensure the government of India to enable the indigenous people democratic constitutional rights by holding the election of Rabha Assam Tribal Council by implementing the Rabha Accord to implement cultural language and cultural identity and representation. Number three, to engage dialogue with the indigenous people to implement the 5 fundamental principles of tribal development enunciated by the Pandit Jawaharlal Nehru in Letter of Spirit in India. Number four, to disseminate the information of UNDRIP. And also ask to Union PF to hold its session. Please. Thank you. Thank you, sir. Thank you.
Please, for lead the interpreters to interpret your statement correctly, please read slowly.
Yes, thank you, sir. Thanks. Sorry, sir. Number four, to disseminate the information of United Nations a declaration of right to indigenous people and follow-up action to strengthen the relationship between government and the indigenous people in India. Number five, to ensure all the UN agencies to have direct access to the indigenous people problems and grievances and to develop effective and meaningful mechanism to address our problems and grievances accordingly. We also asked United Nations Permanent Forum for Indigenous Issue to hold its sessions in different countries rather than holding its sessions always in New York, focusing and prioritizing more on ground situations where the indigenous people are facing serious problems in their survival and coexistence. I thank you for your kind attention, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Thank you. I would like now to call Mikhail Bukodev, World Render Herders Association from Russia. Yeah, you have the floor, sir.
From India, right?
Yes, yes. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I would like to thank for an opportunity to address our comments regarding the special report study on the impact of climate change adaptation and mitigation measures on reindeer herding, reported by the member of Permanent Forum, Mr. Lars Anders Baer. The terrestrial ecosystems in the northern areas are complex ecosystems. The changes in these ecosystems are now taking place rapidly due to climatic changes and the effects of the industrial development of the Arctic. It is therefore important that we use all available knowledge, both scientific as social sciences and especially the indigenous people's traditional ecosystem knowledge, to understand the changes and plan for the future. This will require a new type of cooperation between herders, researchers, industry, management and governments. Experience has shown that many world environmental problems are not solved by use only of conventional science with linear cause-effect approaches. A priority must be to provide the authorities with better management tools. Reindeer peoples respond to changes in the environment has traditionally relied on flexible operating practices that are now hampered because of several non-climatic factors, such as permanent loss of grazing land due to economical development. So it can be said that loss of pastures is the most important issue for reindeer herders today. Because of growing human activity in the Arctic as a result of climate change, there is a need to find ways to regulate this activity and be ahead of the development. Natural resource development, transport and tourism represent some of the drivers in the development. Now there is a situation when the only losing side often are reindeer herders. We lose both from climate change and now plus from industrial development. We lose our pastures every moment permanently. There are many cases, some of them were described also in this report across the Arctic in such countries as Norway, Sweden, Finland and Russia. So we support that there is a need to develop and implement integrated management plans for reindeer pastures in the Arctic on national levels to secure future sustainability of indigenous herding communities and cultures in the face of climate change and land use change in the Arctic region. And this should be done on the international level within the framework of United Nations. We also support the conclusion of the study that there is an urgent need to facilitate investigation and studies within the United Nations framework on changes of grazing land in the reindeer herding areas in the circumpolar north, to establish a holistic and integrated understanding of the ongoing rapid changes in the reindeer herding communities, partly driven by climate change and globalization, in order to maintain the sustainability and resilience of indigenous reindeer herding communities and cultures in the future. We support the proposal and ready for collaboration in development of a new study and propose a title for it, Circumpolar Reindeer Pastoralism, Permanent Loss of Reindeer Pastures, Needs for Documentation of Traditional Ecological Knowledge on Pastures. In this regard, we also acknowledge the significance of our cooperation with UNEP Greta Rendell on the project Impact of Land Use Change and Climate Change on Nomadic Herders, linking reindeer herders of the taiga with yak herders in the Himalaya. In the end of my statement, on behalf of World Reindeer Herders, I would like to thank Special Rapporteur Mr. Lars Anders Behr for this significant report. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I would like now to call Madam Fatima Mohammed, Ethiopian World Federation. Madam Fatima Mohammed. She's here? Yeah, you have the floor, please.
In the name of God most gracious, most merciful, to the ninth permanent forum on indigenous issues, greetings, permanent forum, indigenous people, and all the attending persons. On behalf of the Ethiopian World Federation, I, Fatima Mohammed, an international representative on behalf of the Ethiopian World Federation, I present to you the recommendation that the indigenous women and children African Caucus be adopted by the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Peoples, issues to assist in alleviating specific issues that plague indigenous African women and children on their indigenous land and indigenous women and children whom have been displaced from their indigenous land. The Indigenous Women and Children Caucus seek to actively activate the Declaration on the Rights of the Indigenous People for the hope of indigenous African women and children. As follows. Matriarchal and patriarchal coexistence. 1. Transform violent behavior of men that is inflicted upon women, which in turn affects children long-term behavior. 2. Sustainable development for economic, social, and ecological issues that are common among women. Second, indigenous Nubian women of Sudan, including Nubians of North and East Africa, are indigenous people who are continually being forcibly displaced of their indigenous land due to many unnatural practices and developments, such as building of dams, disease, climate change, wars, and chemical pestilence. Thus, harmful chemical substances, one, destruction of indigenous land, architecture, wildlife, crops, culture, traditions, and family structure were destroyed due to the building of the Aswan Merwe Dal Kabjar. That dam is in the United Arab Republic, and the Merwe Dal dams, and many more. Two, due to infectious and emotional diseases such as malaria, cancer, HIV, AIDS, hysteria, depression, and much more diseases. Ms. Fatima, the chairman interrupts. Ms. Fatima, Madam Fatima, I would like to present your recommendation in writing to the forum. The chairman would, I would like, after making this statement, to give the floor now to the representative of the government of Indonesia. Ms. Grata has the floor. Indonesia has the floor. You have the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, esteemed members of the forum, allow me to reiterate the importance of the forum's work and its role in promoting the principles and ideals that the United Nations was founded on. As the member of the United Nations, Indonesia comes to this forum with an enduring commitment to guarantee justice, equality, prosperity for its people. Mr. Chairman, as a multicultural, multi-ethnic, and multilingual society, Indonesia takes pride in its mosaic of people, which has evolved from our country's long history of tolerance and solidarity. This long standing of tolerance and solidarity inspired the birth of our state philosophy, unity in diversity, which was the unifying foundation of Indonesia's plural society. This philosophy has been the driving force behind Indonesia's democratic process that has begun since the nation's independence 6 decades ago. Indonesia's democracy has been evolving in the face of changing political landscape. New challenges have emerged that have demanded a thorough reform process taken from the hard lesson in the recent past. The process has resulted in remarkable transformation of Indonesia. A decade of nationwide effort to establish a new foundation for political, economic, and social life has reoriented Indonesia's development strategy to strike a balance between economic growth, democracy, and respect for human rights. The process of reform and democracy include implementation of the new laws on regional autonomy. Under the new law, the local government are guaranteed greater self-rule and larger share of revenue for local constituencies. The peaceful democratic process and regional autonomy has empowered the local people to determine their region development in accordance with their needs and aspiration. Nevertheless, the government of Indonesia recognized that we still need to do more, even when things have changed so much and so fast. We believe that the regional autonomy will benefit will continue benefit the peoples. Most importantly, to democracy and reform, we hope that equality, justice, and prosperity are reinforced for all Indonesians. Mr. Chairman, in discussing the future work of Permanent Forum, we acknowledge and encourage by the work of the Forum on Climate Change and the impact of economic and financial crisis on development. Those issues are among the top priorities for Indonesia. And we have been working with the international community to ensure a comprehensive strategy and framework which takes into account the need of all countries and its people. Mr. Chairman, we also wish to re-emphasize the call to improve the forum's methods of work. We fervently view that the continued improvement of its working method is the key to the overall success of the forum and therefore encourage the study of other functional commission procedures as a guiding tools. Indonesia reiterates that the principle of free, prior, and informed consent must be applied at every phase of the forum decision-making process. This will ensure a greater transparency, responsibility, trust, and accountability of the forum when it deals with the issue that requires its attention. Finally, we are certain that the Secretariat of the Forum will always continue to uphold its solemn responsibility in safeguarding the trust of the member state. This is crucial in maintaining the Forum credibility and effectiveness at all times. I thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, the representative of Indonesia, Madam Grata, and I would like to give the floor to the government of Vietnam, the representative of Vietnam government.
So what I wanted to add in terms of this.
He's in the room. Yes. You.
I thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, you have the right. You have the floor, please.
What? Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Indeed, I speak in exercising my right to reply. I'd like to speak in response to the statement made earlier by the representative of the so-called Khmer Krom Federation and Muntanap Foundation, which is based on totally fabricated and distorted information about the government of Vietnam. As always, my delegation would like to express our opposition to the participation of these individuals and wishes to remind the forum that they do not represent any ethnic minority groups in the country. Rather, they have carried out separatist activities out of their own political motivation. And my delegation would like to reiterate the Vietnam's policy to ensure equality, unity, and mutual respect among all ethnicities and forbid all forms of ethnicity-based discrimination. This is guaranteed by the Constitution and the entire legal system and is strictly implemented in practice through a series of socio-economic development programs. The government has also paid great attention to preserving traditional cultures of ethnic minority groups, particularly their languages and cultural identities. In order to save time for the forum, instead of going into details of their policies and their implementation in reply to the shameful slanders of the above said groups, I would rather invite the delegation to look at the fact sheet on the situation of Vietnam, Vietnamese ethnic minority groups and the Vietnam government's policy toward them, which will be available in the information desk, and which is also can be found in Annex 6 of our national report under the Universal Periodic Review of the Human Rights Council. I thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Shukran lihukuma.
Thank you for the government of Vietnam for kindly explaining its position. But I believe that the forum is a place for dialogue of this sort. Therefore, the representatives of the NGOs and the organizations that come here express their opinions, and the governments may approve of that and accept it or express their opinions in turn. So I hope that the dialogue would be open in an open way between the governments and the representatives of the NGOs and the representatives of the indigenous people throughout the world. I give the floor now to Madam Awiya Abu Rabia. From the Forum of Civil Equality.
Opportunity to speak. It is an honor to speak on behalf of the Negev Coexistence Forum for Civil Equality, a grassroots nonprofit organization, and share our views on the implementation of the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People in the State of Israel with respect to the Arab Bedouins. The Bedouins Arab of the Negev, the southern desert region of Israel, are indigenous people. They were traditionally a semi-nomadic people and subsisted on dry farming and small cattle or even better sheep and goats. Following the establishment of the State of Israel in 1948, however, when the desert became part of its territory, the Bedouin were displaced from most of their lands. To this day, the State of Israel continues to violate the indigenous rights of the Bedouin. Today, there are approximately 190,000 Bedouins Arab living in the Negev. Half of this population lives in eight failing government planned towns, while the other half live in dozens of villages that are not recognized by the government. These villages do not appear on Israeli maps or government planning documents. There are no road signs even indicating their existence. There are typically villages of 60 to 600 families living in tents and shacks. While they are citizens, they do not have access to the most basic services, such as running water, electricity, roads, or even proper education,
you are health, speaking too fast.
And welfare services.
You are speaking too fast.
They live under the constant threat of home demolition, as it is illegal to build permanent structure in these villages, crop destruction, and other further displacement. The Israeli government continues to refuse to recognize these villages, and many land claims that were failed more than three decades ago are not progressed. Over 300-600 legal claims have been submitted by the Bedouin to claim back their land. However, to date, very few of these claims have reached a conclusion. In 2009, 254 homes were destroyed. Neither Article 3 nor Article 32 of the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People, which are the focus of this session, are currently respected by the State of Israel. With respect to Article 3, the right to self-determination, Bedouin who live in this in the area of a Jewish Regional Council usually live in unrecognized villages and are not eligible to vote in municipal election. Thus, thousands are not represented by a municipal authority and cannot participate in local election. The Jewish National Fund, which has been granted quasi-governmental power in Israel as part of the Israeli Land Administration, also continue to act in direct contravention of Article 32, which sets out the obligation to consult and cooperate with indigenous people in order to obtain their free and informed consent prior to the approval of any project affecting their lands. In 2003, the JNF introduced its Blueprint Negev initiative to revitalize Israel's southern desert region, increase the Jewish population, and, I quote, improve living conditions for all its inhabitants. Persistent to this initiative, the GNF had planted tens of thousands of trees in the Negev and created numerous parks with neither the consent nor cooperation of the indigenous owners of the land in question. As a result, residents of many unrecognized villages have been forced off the land and can no longer use it for grazing or agricultural purposes. It has become increasingly clear that the Israeli government sanctioned JNF-funded activity to indirectly and arbitrarily confiscate yet more land from the Bedouins. We urge the Permanent Forum to recommend to the Human Rights Council that the Bedouin must be allowed to remain in their villages and these villages must be recognized. The activities of the Jewish National Fund be put on hold until the ownership claims are determined by the court. Thank you, Chairman.
And then give the floor to this, to the Federation.
The next speaker on our list is Mr. Guilo Nechil from the Federation of the Saskatchewan Indigenous Nations, Health and Social Development of Canada and the United States. We will ask them to speak not too fast so that the interpreters can do their job properly. You have the floor.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning. I speak on behalf of Chief Guy Lonechild, who was called away to another important situation back at home, and my name is Wes George. Mr. Chairman, considering the topic and current agenda item, we would like to make a couple of observations and recommendations for the Permanent Forum to integrate into their program of activities. Concerning the preliminary study on the Doctrine of Discovery, we notice that the Indigenous Peoples of Canada component is absent and needs to be examined in detail and included. We realize the value of the study, but more importantly, the results and changes that can be made with a complete study. Currently, Canadian Supreme Court decisions and Canadian jurisprudence are made that impact on Indigenous peoples and our rights, lands, and treaties, all based on the Doctrine of Discovery. There currently exists outstanding and unfinished business that is relevant to the work of the Permanent Forum. For instance, the UN study on treaties, agreements, and other constructive arrangements that remains to be fully implemented. The study made several observations, conclusions, and recommendations for the UN to consider ways of integrating the essence and purpose of the study into their work. Of great importance to us is the conclusions of the Special Rapporteur Martinez, who found that our treaties, in fact, and practice retain international status, character, and responsibility, and that the 1969 Vienna Convention on the Law of Treaties applies. Further, the Special Rapporteur Martinez had recommended that three treaty expert seminars be held. These remain as unfinished business. We recommend that the two UN treaty seminars held in 2003 and 2006 be enforced and fully implemented, and to carry out the third seminar as mandated by the UN Economic and Social Council. We also recommend that a World Conference on Indigenous Peoples be organized and sponsored by the United Nations to mark the end of the second decade of the world's Indigenous Peoples. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Hi, hi.
Gracias. Thank you very much, sir. The next speaker on our list is Mr. Carlos Eden Mayel from the International Native Tradition. Is Mr. Eden Mayel in the room? Mr. Eden, you have the floor. Are you in the room? Well, then we'll move on to the next speaker. Mr. Tom Goltu from the network of the Indigenous and Environment Network, Global Caucus. Mr. Glutu, you have the floor. Tomas Goltu, Diente de Oro.
Mr. Chairman, distinguished members of the Permanent Forum and all delegates and participants, brothers and sisters, my intervention will be very brief. On behalf of the Indigenous Environmental Network, we recognize the excellent study that was submitted and reported during this ninth session of the Permanent Forum. This report is entitled Study to Determine Whether Climate Change Policies and Projects Adhere to the Standards of the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. To complement this report, The Indigenous Environmental Network recognizes the need for continued work in this area by the Permanent Forum in light of increased human rights abuses against Indigenous peoples by climate change mitigation initiatives. These climate change mitigation initiatives, specifically of concern, include but are not limited to carbon trading and carbon offset projects negatively impacting Indigenous peoples, for an example, such as the Ogiak of Kenya, and hydro dams financed by clean development mechanisms and lack of protection mechanisms that are leading to carbon trading scandals, such as what happened in Papua New Guinea, in which villagers were coerced to sign land and forest rights away. We therefore propose a study to be initiated specifically on the human rights impacts of climate mitigation measures to be presented at the 10th session of the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Gracias a usted.
Thank you very much, sir. Our next speaker is Alexandra Grigorieva of Yutamira. Madam Grigorieva, you have the floor. Could you raise your hand, please? Ms. Grigorieva?
Announce that you are that he is willing to switch to the time.
Vamos a regresar al.
Let us get back then to item 4, and we will also look at the list for item 3. Now I'm going to give the floor Ms. Mareva Levy de Monkluk of the Nutu Loa Association. You have the floor, ma'am.
Les discriminations dont se sont victimes.
The discrimination victimizing a great many indigenous peoples of French Polynesia in the areas of territorial properties. Since 1946, there has been a transformation of the French government in French Polynesia, and the indigenous populations have been faced with a reversal of collective law. The indigenous peoples in French Polynesia are strongly attached to their identity as a Pacific nation, and their national territory is very far from the territory of France. Contemporary society and the democratic functions of institutions, as organized by the Organic Law of 2004 in French Polynesia. This statute delegates competence to local governments on a number of important issues. Also, issues such as civic laws and rights, justice and foreign policy, defense, and the entry and establishment of foreigners, the currency, credit, and the financial markets, and so on. And the beginning of this 21st century, and given the difficulty in living under the tutelage of a foreign country, our people are concerned with their lands. We do not want to give up our culture or our language, which is experience a rebirth. Recommendation: to declare that the indigenous peoples of the world have the right to decide for themselves And in the exercise of that right, we demand that respect be given to a holistic indigenous view of the world and the family relations with nature, and that all development negotiations be governed by those philosophical ideals. We demand that the Yitzhak Native peoples be acknowledged as depositaries of the national resources in their territories and their cultural and intellectual goods, and must be the primary beneficiaries of those intellectual property rights and cultural rights. We demand that the international community reinforce and implement vigorous measures for implementation as of now. We call for a priority for the rights of our peoples by virtue of the 1880 treaty. In consequence, we call for the acknowledgement of the collective rights of indigenous peoples. And despite the fact that this is sometimes implemented in New Caledonia, also French Polynesia should be placed among the list of countries to be decolonized. We were unilaterally removed from that list without our free prior informed consent. Thank you very much.
Muchas gracias.
Thank you very much, ma'am. The next speaker is Ayla Bakali, representing the Tartars of Crimea.
Thank you. Distinguished Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, I am honored to greet you on behalf of the Majlis of the Crimean Tatar people, the representative body of the indigenous Crimean Tatars. The indigenous Crimean Tatars of Crimea, Ukraine, cannot overemphasize to the forum the real urgency to address the need in the preservation of its indigenous linguistic and cultural identity. In order to preserve one's cultural heritage, the importance of language in producing identity cannot be overemphasized. Language, which then becomes the seedbed and instrument of empowerment for and in our own self-determination. In its advice to the Economic and Social Council, we request that the forum calls upon the action that UN take towards the Crimean Tatar issue and highly recommends to the Ukrainian government to develop the programs that would preserve linguistic and cultural identity of the Crimean Tatars. It is crucial for us that those programs include the four issues: construction of schools and preschool facilities in the indigenous Crimean Tatar settlements, renovation of unique historical and architectural objects of Crimean Tatar cultural heritage, assistance in the development of digital print media in the Crimean Tatar language, assistance in easing the mechanism of repatriation for over 100,000 Crimean Tatars who are still in exile against their will. I would like to conclude. Indigenous people who have been historically repressed under the former Soviet regime hold a unique dynamics between the nation states they reside in that it places the indigenous Crimean Tatars in competition to address its specific indigenous issues with the nation state that has been historically repressed.
Ruego a usted terminar su intervención.
Please wind up your intervention, ma'am.
Put my last two statements. I would like to introduce to the forum that in 2009, the World Congress of Crimean Tatars was formed as a Ukrainian-registered NGO, and at this historic event, Crimean Tatars, who were deported from their homeland on May 18, 1944, returned to the homeland to participate at this World Congress and begun the work to address the complex and difficult difficult issues of deported people. I thank you, Chairman, for this opportunity.
Gracias a usted. Nuestra próxima hora.
Thank you, ma'am. Justa Cabrera de Flores is our following speaker. You have the floor, Ms. Cabrera.
Muchas gracias, señor presidente.
Thank you very much, sir. I would like to speak about what has happened in the last few days. In my country, as the Confederation of Indigenous Women of Bolivia, we and the Bolivian delegation would like to state here this morning that there must be respect for the freedom of speech of the indigenous peoples, and especially the indigenous women. Here this morning, I would also like to state that the Declaration of Human Rights adopted by the United Nations has been, for us, a milestone in history that has become a tool in our struggle, the struggle of the indigenous peoples. However, I think it is going to remain nothing more than a written statement, because all of the states that have adopted it and approved it and turned it into law, it is existing as a law in our countries, but the rights of the indigenous peoples are still violated. They are not allowed to make decisions with regard to the natural resources. There are indigenous territories in my country that have been declared autonomous, but they are not able to decide on their lands or their natural resources. I would also like to express here this morning that despite the fact that our president is a member of an indigenous nation, we, the indigenous people in the lowlands, are discriminated. We are still called a minority, and they are attempting to amend the laws that defend the laws of the indigenous peoples of the lowlands. We're in mixed community lands. They are going to disappear the East and Amazon Chaco lands. So, sir, this morning I would like to call on the Permanent Forum to analyze and study rigorously the situation we are experiencing as indigenous peoples of the lowlands in Bolivia, as you are perfectly knowledgeable about, sir. Thank you.
Muchas gracias, señora.
Thank you very much, Ms. Justa Cabrera. The next speaker, Blanca Chancosa Sanchez, of the Andean Coordinator of Indigenous Organizations. Blanca Chancos, are you here, ma'am?
No está la señora Blanca Chancos.
Blanca Chancos is not present. The next speaker is Makiko Kimura of Chiming Guaiku Human Rights Center in Asia. Ms. Makiko, or Mr. Makiko, you have the floor, sir.
I'm going to speak on behalf of Makiko. She has already left. This is the collective statement of the Chimingaku Center, Chin Human Rights Organization, and PACOS. The UN RIB was adopted by General Assembly in 2007. As many of us know, the government of Japan voted in favor of that term. As a result, in Japan, a resolution to recognize the Ainu as an indigenous people was passed by a unanimous vote in the National Diet in 2008, and A council to promote Ainu policy was established in the government at the end of 2009. Although no Ainu rights have been yet granted, we may recognize a certain limited progress in Ainu policy since 2007 at domestic level. Having said that, we are deeply concerned about reluctance of the Japanese government to disseminate the UN DRIP and to embrace its spiritual, legal, and political implication. For example, the state government of Mobetsu, a municipality of Hokkaido Prefecture, authorized a plan to build an industrial waste dumping site near the Mobetsu River on February 26, 2010. Prior to the authorization, a local Ainu community in Mobetsu, working in collaboration with local Japanese groups supporting for environmental conservation, demand that the city government to respect the UN DRIP, including land, cultural, and environmental rights, and to review the plan from the indigenous people perspective. However, unfortunately, the city government has not given any consideration to the Ainu rights, particularly their free, prior, informed consent in authorization of this project. The Mobetsu River is one of the most important places for coexistence between the Ainu culture and the national environment. Unlike other rivers in Hokkaido, there was no dam in the river. And the authorization of the construction by the state government does not only violate Article 29 of UN DRIP, but also seriously violate the Ainu right to free, prior, informed consent, which is clearly stated in Article 32. It also denies an important role of indigenous and local community to preserve biodiversity, which is stipulated in the Article 8 of Convention, the CBD. We are concerned about initiative by the government of Japan on these issues, as Japan will be the chair of the COP10 of CBD, which will be held in Nagoya in forthcoming October 2010. Taking into account of that, I would like to make the following recommendation. One, we recommend the government of Japan shall establish national and local system in conjunction with indigenous people to obtain their free, prior, informed consent to the approval of any project affecting their lands and territory and other resources in accordance with UN DRIP. And we recommend that the city government of Mobetsu shall respect free, prior, informed consent of the local Ainu community concerned and to reconsider the authorization of the industrial waste dumping site. Lastly, we request the special rapporteur on the situation of human rights and fundamental freedom of indigenous people shall use his good office to directly intervene in the government of Japan regarding the construction of the industrial waste dumping site in Mobetsu City, Hokkaido Prefecture. Thank you, Mr. Chairperson.
Muchas gracias, señor.
Thank you very much, sir. Our next speaker is Mr. Darwin Hill of the American Indian Law Alliance. Mr. Hill, you have the floor, sir.
Yawaskeno, Kugwego. Greetings from the Haudenosaunee, the Six Nations, to the members of the Permanent Forum, all the states' delegations, and the indigenous brothers and sisters here. I'm presenting a statement on the doctrine of discovery. This intervention will be brief, but direct and to the point. Start out with a recommendation that an expert group meeting and comprehensive study of the doctrine of discovery be conducted by a representative from each of the seven regions identified by the Permanent Forum, and that Tanya Ganella Frischer be appointed to represent the North American region. This is the background for this recommendation. At its eighth session in 2009, the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues appointed Ms. Tanya Ganella Frischer as a special rapporteur of the Permanent Forum to conduct a preliminary study on the impact of Indigenous peoples, quote, of the international construct known as the Doctrine of Discovery, which has served as a foundation for the violation of their human rights, unquote. The preliminary study has been presented to the Permanent Forum at this session as requested and is now available for distribution. Recognizing the importance of the preliminary study of the Doctrine of Discovery to indigenous nations and peoples, the Haudenosaunee support a further comprehensive study of the Doctrine of Discovery to assess to what extent it has affected indigenous peoples in the seven regions of the world identified by the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues. We also support the convening of an expert group meeting on the Doctrine of Discovery and the appointment of Tanya Ganella Fritcher as the representative from the North American region. Thank you for the opportunity to present this statement today. Danito.
Gracias, señor.
Thank you, sir. Now, the floor to our distinguished colleague, Victoria Tauli Corpus. You have the floor, ma'am.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairperson. I would like to take this opportunity to read a statement that was written by the International Indigenous Women's Forum in relation to the agenda item Beijing plus 10 and plus 15 and Indigenous Women, and also on behalf of myself as a member of the forum. As you are aware, there is the Beijing plus 15 event is going to be take place, and Indigenous women have been present in Beijing when the Beijing Platform of Action for Women has been approved, and this is supposed to be implemented through all these years. Important progress can be acknowledged since the adoption of the Beijing's Platform of Action in 1995. At the international level, Indigenous peoples and women have been conquering important spheres, both with regards to the recognition of their rights through a series of specific instruments and also with regards to the adoption of policies within the United Nations system. Similarly, at the national level, there have been great achievements at the legal and constitutional levels, as well as the establishment of governmental institutions for indigenous peoples in the development of specific policies and their inclusion in general measures. However, significant inequalities still remain amongst indigenous peoples and women and non-indigenous people and women, both in general and within each country. In order to examine what each country has done to address the needs and issues of indigenous women, we reviewed the greater part of national-level reports submitted by each country in the following regions: Europe, Latin America, Caribbean, Asia, the Pacific, and Africa. The purpose of this review was to survey what each country has done to implement gender mainstreaming practices as they relate specifically to indigenous women. We have noted how each country has included or not the particular priorities of indigenous women. The methodology used to review these reports included reading through each country report and locating where and in which context terms such as aboriginal, indigenous, native, ethnic, nomadic, minority, and rural women were used. We also noted where a country mentioned a specific indigenous group. The International Indigenous Women's Forum is especially concerned about the manifestation of racism and discrimination in various ways: political violence, impunity, stereotypes and discourses reproduced by society as a whole, poor access to public services, both in quantity and quality, discriminatory treatment by public officials, unequal access to lands, and denial of their participation in decision-making processes concerning them. This reality faced by indigenous peoples, and particularly indigenous women, is invisible in statistics, and the marginalization and exclusion of indigenous peoples is hidden behind national averages and global progress indicators. Considering the central role of indigenous women in their own people's development processes, the fact that they are vital for
for the transmission of cultural practices essential to indigenous identity, such as language, ancestral history, medicinal knowledge, and socialization patterns, among others, and considering also that women are key actors for change processes of their own cultures, we recommend that, number one, member states, UN agencies, and other relevant agencies should support intercultural prevention and eradication strategies with regards to violence against indigenous women designed and driven by indigenous women's organizations, and considering an indigenous conceptualization of gender-based violence. Number two, facilitate access and promotion of full and effective participation of indigenous women in decision-making spheres at all levels in administration and civil service, government action, government bodies, political parties, judiciary, trade unions, and others, considering the leadership and training processes as pillars of participation. Number three, ensure statistical data disaggregation by sex and ethnicity, discourage monitoring focused only on national averages, ensure indigenous peoples and indigenous women's effective participation in all stages of preparation, coordination, and implementation of data collection, develop a proper system of indicators in partnership with indigenous peoples and women, and enable a measurement of progress in the different areas. Number four, include ethnic identification in vital statistics and health records. Allocate more funding for intercultural services that ensure indigenous women's access to quality health care, including emergency obstetric care, voluntary family planning, and skilled attendance at delivery, strengthening and extending the role of traditional midwives. Finally, promote and support development processes led and carried out by indigenous women's organizations in accordance with Articles 3 and 32 of the UN Declaration on Rights of Indigenous Peoples. For instance, leadership and capacity building schools and the creation of funds managed by indigenous women themselves. In conclusion, we highlight the commitment of the International Indigenous Women's Forum in implementing the recommendations adopted by the Permanent Forum, the Program of Action of the Second Decade, and the Articles of the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Gracias, señora Tauli.
Thank you, Ms. Tauli Corpus. The next person on my list is Mr. Palak Chatma of the Bandiyan Foundation, Bangladesh. Are you in the hall, sir?
La palabra.
If not, I will call upon my next speaker of the Cultural Survival Organization of Kenya. Cultural Survival of Kenya, are you here?
La señora Graciela, nuestra próxima oradora entonces.
The following speaker is Graciliano Celestino Gomez da Silva of the Intertribal Council, Indigenous Memory and Science of Brazil. Celestino, are you here?
Vamos a seguir. No. Vamos a seguir con nuestra.
The next person on my list, Leonard Mbidi of West Papua. Is Mr. Mbidi present?
Can go from the joint speakers, go from here, go from like India.
Señor Joseph.
Joseph Marianos Cujur of the Chotanagpur Rising Association of the Indian Social Institute. Mr. Cujur?
If you want to. They are here, but this is the guy. But do you want to give him, ask him? This is the guy who asks for the floor, but does he want to give him the floor?
Yeah.
Nuestro próximo orador.
The next speaker, Denise El Mahar of Syria Universal Alliance. Is the speaker present? You have the floor, sir.
Tiene la palabra. Estamos siempre escasos de tiempo.
You have the floor. Please remember, we are short of time.
Shalom al-Kulhul. Greetings to all of you. As we say in our Aramaic mother tongue, we congratulate this special rapporteur on his designation to this honorable post and wish him a successful forum. The Syriac Universal Alliance is the only recognized speaking NGO, Aramaic speaking NGO, in consultative status with the Economic and Social Council of the United Nations. We represent the indigenous people of Turkey, Syria, Iraq, and Lebanon. Yet we, the Arameans, otherwise known as Syriacs, have never been recognized as such and continue to be forgotten people in the Middle East. In addition, our ancient cultural heritage and language are in serious danger of extinction. Mr. Chairperson, we make the following recommendations to the Parliament Permanent Forum. One. The Permanent Forum urges the Special Rapporteur on the situation of human rights and fundamental freedoms of indigenous people to seek an invitation from the governments of Turkey, Syria, Iraq, and Lebanon to examine and report on the human rights situations of the Aramean Syriac people living within their territories. Two, the Permanent Forum dedicate a half-day meeting of the 10th session of the Permanent Forum to examine issues pertaining to indigenous peoples of the Middle East, with special reference to the Aramean Syriac people. Our Aramean history spans more than 3,000 years. Aramaic is the oldest surviving language of the Middle East, and our pre-Christian and Christian ancestors have contributed much to the world's civilization, culture, and religion. Allow me to mention a few out by example. One, prior to Arabic, the Aramaic language of the Aramean was the international language of the entire Middle East between 8th BC and 7th century AD. Aramaic, which today became known as the language of Jesus Christ, is the language of certain books, phrases, and words in the Old and New Testament. In fact, the Jewish Bible identifies the patriarchs and matriarchs of Jewish people as Arameans, who originated from southeast Turkey, where we come from. Our Aramean ancestors and language have played a major part and a major role between 7th and 10th century AD as intermediaries and teachers in transmitting Mesopotamian and Greek sciences and Arabic-speaking world. Until today, Arameans have never enjoyed any basic rights in Turkey, since they do not exist officially and have no legal status. In 2007, Turkey endorsed the United Nations Declaration of Rights of Indigenous People, and it is the duty of the international community to urge Turkish government to recognize the true status of Aramean Syriac people as the indigenous people of the region. We are delighted by Turkey's support for the declaration, yet disappointed by the unfortunate comment made by its delegate, We can easily refute this baseless assertion and prove the existence of 3,000 years of Aramaeans and their language in Turkey, many, many centuries before the Arabs,
Señor,
Turks, and Kurds.
Sir?
Can I have... My statement could not be read out. Obviously, I was trying to...
Thank you.
Only take another 1 minute of the time. I'd much appreciate it. It's taken us 4 or 5 days to even get to this. So 1 minute, Mr. Chairperson, I'd most appreciate that.
Muchas gracias.
Thank you very much. The next speaker on our list is Mr. Miguel Palacinkiskis of the Andean Coordination of Indigenous Peoples. You have the floor, sir. Good morning to all distinguished brothers and sisters and distinguished diplomatic representatives of the various states here. I come from South America, and in coordination I'm in coordination with various communities and organizations, indigenous organizations. Now, recently, our peoples are coping with it. A very serious emergency of the systematic militarization and criminalization. Some certain legislative measures are in fact threatening the collective rights of indigenous peoples. Now, we want to go on record here in this forum that there's a serious threat hanging over the 32 indigenous nations of Colombia. 18 nations in Colombia are threatened with disappearance. Some of them have been displaced by military violence. Some have been persecuted for defending their lands. They're under threat in Colombia. There are 32 nations with 500 inhabitants, 18 with less than 18 inhabitants, 10 with less than 100. And the Constitutional Committee of Colombia has only included or recognized two nations. And yet there is a very serious emergency that is occurring, and legislative steps are being taken in Peru, for example, around the Bagua conflict, and the events of June 5th of last year have in fact made the situation very serious for indigenous peoples. This is why we would ask the permanent forum for indigenous peoples to issue a recommendation aimed at protecting the rights of indigenous peoples under threat of extinction, physical and cultural extinction, specifically highlighting the case of Colombia that I just mentioned. Equally, the recommendations of the Special Rapporteur, which have been issued by the Constitutional Court of Colombia with respect to protecting the indigenous peoples threatened with extinction. We would also ask the forum to send a urgent mission to Colombia in order to report on the severe consequences that the measures taken in Colombia have on the existence of indigenous peoples. We would also like ask the permanent forum to recommend to the governments that in developing countries to take into account in their development policies plans for indigenous peoples and the development of their identity and culture, and today in this new paradigm to include mechanisms for the development of and the well-being of their nations. We also ask the forum to include militarization and criminalization in the 10th period, sessional period, to examine, to analyze these two notions. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Mr. Palacian. Our next speaker is Mrs. Larissa Harway from the Center of the Fourth World on Laws and Policies. Is Mrs. Larissa Harvey in the room? You have the floor, madam.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for giving me the floor. I am going to intervene on the first, on the theme, the main theme, because I was not present. I didn't have the opportunity to travel, as all of you know. Central African sub-region is known for its ethnic diversity, where some groups identify themselves as indigenous people. The groups are amongst the most vulnerable and highly marginalized and include the hunter-gatherers who inhabit the equatorial forest. These groups are the Baka, Baigeli, Bakola, and the Bejang. Another group include the Bororo pastoralists, numbering about 2 million people in the sub-region. They are essentially nomads and semi-nomads. Recognition of indigenous people in the sub-region. Most of the constitutions of the countries of the sub-region make allusions to protection of indigenous and minorities, but do not specify which groups they are talking about. And most often it is relegated to the preamble of the constitution, with the exception of the Central African Republic Constitution, which mentions some of the groups by names. And of course, you people are aware that the Central African Republic has just ratified the Convention 169 of the International Labour Organization. Two countries of the region has also embarked on laws for special protection of these groups. While the Republic of Congo had made great advances, Cameroon has made a U-turn on its initiative and has asked for a study on the question. The application of Article 3 and 32 of the UN Declaration for these groups will be a pretentious and overzealous idea. The recognition of this group is problematic to Africa as a whole and to the region in particular. Many hunter-gatherers have been displaced from the forest without prior and free consent and have set up their homes and camps along the highways. The reason for the displacements are concession to logging companies, the creation of reserves to create room for pipelines and agro-industrial companies. Generally, the neighboring dominant communities see them as impostors on these lands and refuse them access to the land and its resources. They survive by offering their services to their neighbors who use them abusively. Several reasons confirm work without payment, and most of the times are paid with alcohol, which worsens the problem of alcoholism and social disruption in these communities. Many cases of sexual abuse of the women by the employers of their husbands are also reported. The dilemma of the Bororos is far from getting to an end. They suffered massive land dispossession in Cameroon in the northwest region. The land dispossession of grazing lands made way for the creation of a private ranch, the Elba Ranch and the Ndawarati Estate, conceded to a multi-billionaire, Alhaji Baba Dampulo, who has persecuted the Bororo community for over two decades. This massive takeover of land was done without prior free consent of the Bororo people. No reallocation or compensation was made to those who lost their lands. All efforts to end his persecution and land takeover has been in vain. The Interministerial Commission of July 2003, instituted by the government, brought to light horrible human rights violations committed by this individual using government officials. This commission made comprehensive recommendations, but to the dismay of the community, the report was never made public nor put into execution. Despite the urgent call for action by the UN Special Rapporteur, the Special Rapporteur on the Independence of Judges and Lawyers, the Special Rapporteur on the Situation of Human Rights and Fundamental Freedoms of Indigenous Peoples, and the Special Representative of the Secretary General concerning the Situation of Human Rights Defenders addressed an urgent communique on the 29th of August 2007 to the government of Cameroon. Not satisfied with the answers of the government, a second communique was sent for more clarification as regards the Interministerial Commission of July 2003. All these efforts have yielded no fruits. harassment, arbitrary arrest, detention, and torture of Mororo men who try to resist the ranchers' domination are frequent in this region.
Señora, we call on the UN.
Madam, could you please wind up your statement?
Commission through its special procedures to recall the Cameroon government to put an end to these human rights violations and exactions. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
The representative of the Republic of Colombia has the floor now. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. My delegation would like to briefly take the floor to make some comments in view of the statements made by some of the participants of the forum and to contribute to providing information that was provided last week by our national delegation last week by the Minister of the Interior, Vice Minister of the Interior, on the respective topics that they dealt with. With respect to the provide additional information vis-a-vis what was said by the representative of the indigenous community who spoke earlier. First of all, with respect to the request of for the forum to send an emergency mission to Colombia, I just want to inform the delegate in question that indeed this is a topic on which was discussed last week, and in line with this recommendation, our government has already announced that it will invite the forum to visit the country, and it has informed the forum so that the mission could be sent in the near future to get a better understanding of the situation of certain communities that are affected by violence. Secondly, with respect to Decision 004090 by the Constitutional Court of Colombia, also the government briefed last week with respect to the advances related to the decisions of the court. These were decisions of the court related to the situations of violence caused by illegal armed groups in the country and that have affected various indigenous peoples and communities. And as the delegate mentioned, specifically pertained to the situation of 32 nations who were particularly vulnerable. The government last week described the progress achieved in the process of coordination and with respect to plans for safeguarding these nations in line with the decisions of the Constitutional Court, And these decisions are already being implemented, and it was mentioned that also that the social policy document that will be adopted by the government of Colombia is seeking to extend this methodology to plan and safeguard these nations, not only with regard to these 32 nations that have been identified by the Constitutional Court, which have been the most affected by the violence of these illegal armed groups, but also to expand this to all indigenous peoples and nations in Colombia, protecting their specificities, cultural identities. I also wanted to just say that because the information, something was said with respect to the recognition of certain nations and by the Constitutional Commission, only four have been recognized. Well, there are some There are 82 indigenous nations, and there are constant ethnological studies carried out to satisfy the requests of indigenous communities in Colombia. Also, others have submitted their request to be recognized as indigenous peoples, to have their collective rights respected. And we're not going to deny that there's a serious problem of violence caused by illegal armed groups in the country that affects all Colombians, and it has affected in particular indigenous peoples, and I wanted to confirm this. And since the idea of this forum is to contribute this dialogue, I just wanted to say that Colombia's goal is to protect the rights of indigenous and to foster dialogue with them to specifically deal with their problems, and wanted to assure you that we are going to continue working with the UN and with this forum, which is a very important forum in this topic, and seeking for the most effective and best mechanisms of action to strengthen and enhance the rights of the indigenous peoples of Colombia. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to thank you for those clarifications. I would now like to give the floor to Bartolomé Clavelo, our colleague. You have the floor. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. With respect to the announcement and it's made and the information made with respect to the situation of indigenous people and with what was said by Colombia, I just want to express a concern or maybe speak a little bit more about it. This is a concern with respect to the situation of indigenous peoples in Colombia. The Colombian government has insisted that it is complying with the decisions of the Constitutional Court with respect to the safeguarding the conditions of indigenous peoples, protecting their human rights and protecting their rights, including the rights to their territory and defense of indigenous territories when indigenous communities are displaced due to military activities and the fact that the refusal to allow companies that extract natural resources to operate there. Now, the efforts of the Colombian government in complying with these decisions of the Constitutional Court and protecting the rights of the indigenous peoples have not yet been fully complied with. And concretely, I want to refer to the last order of the Constitutional Court, which directly is directed to the Ministry of National Defense of Colombia, ordering it that it conduct a study to see why indigenous communities should be defended by the Colombian army, whereas Colombian government. Well, the Constitutional Court has said that if the indigenous peoples are against the Colombian army, that must be for a reason, and that we mandate that you conduct a study for the reasons why for this presence, this rejection by the indigenous peoples of the Colombian army. This is a situation that does not give rise to much confidence to those who share this concern with respect to what whether the Colombian government is in a position to effectively protect the indigenous peoples, even while these indigenous peoples reject this very protection. That is just an idea that I wanted to develop here with respect to the latest mandate or decision by the Constitutional Court of Colombia that it has issued for the Colombian government. Thank you very much, Mr. Clavelo. I'd now like to give the floor to our distinguished colleague, Tonia Gonella Frichnes. Mrs. Gonella, you have the floor.
Mr. Chairman, in reference to Beijing plus 15, I would like to make a statement, please, if I may. Mr. Chairman, as my area is North America, and I have been working with several Native women's associations, particularly in Canada and the United States, I wanted to bring to your attention a plan, a national action plan, which is being proposed, which includes a dedicated advocacy with all levels of government in Canada through the best means possible. And this would bring clear focus and attention to this issue of women's issues, including making authorities more accountable for their actions. And I wanted to bring to your attention certain points that I'd like to highlight in this plan. And one of these points, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 of these points, recognize violence faced by indigenous women, The other position is work to build an effective and unbiased police response through appropriate training, to supply adequate resources and coordination to address violence, to improving public awareness and accountability through the consistent collection and publication of comprehensive national statistics on rates of violent crime against Indigenous women, and include support to reduce the risk to Aboriginal women by closing the economic and social gap between Indigenous and non-Indigenous people in Canada. I think this national action plan being proposed by the Native and Women's Association of Canada is an excellent idea that should be given close scrutiny. And also one more point. While the issue of missing and murdered Indigenous women has gained increasing public attention in Canada, especially within the Permanent Forum, other forms of racialized and sexualized violence, including trafficking and family violence, also require immediate action. Across Canada, there are less than 40 emergency shelters serving Indigenous women, which are certainly not enough. There is a need for better victim services and specific programs to assist Indigenous women who have been trafficked, and we would like more attention brought to this particular issue. Thank you so much for your attention, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, ma'am. We will continue with our list of speakers. The next speaker is Mrs. Patricia Rivera, representing various Latin American organizations. You have the floor, madam. I'll speak on behalf of Patricia, who's in the room. I'll leave you her statement.
Señor Presidente.
Mr. Chairman, members of the forum, brothers, sisters, we would like to respectfully greet you in this period. Now, the paradigms of development, modernization, and industrialization have often led to the destruction of ancestral development systems and led to a competition between various concepts of development and have harmed Indigenous peoples and have been an obstacle to true progress, the harnessing of their own resources, the protection of their ancestral territories. We Indigenous peoples do not want this to continue, that these multinational companies in fact, trample over our interests and trample our human rights, collective rights, and the rights to the collective determination. And leaving the only thing that they leave in their wake is hunger, pollution, etc. We request a forum that ECOSOC strongly urge member states to adopt the Universal Declaration of the United Nations for the rights of indigenous people, and to transpose this declaration into the legislation of all countries, that the Universal Declaration of the United Nations is acknowledged and implemented for the rights of Indigenous peoples by the states, member states, and by the United Nations itself, respecting and strengthening the rights of Indigenous peoples. The United Nations should promote funds that make it possible to translate the declaration in the traditional indigenous languages. That it also urges the government of Panama to heed the recommendation of the Committee of Human Rights of the UN and the Inter-American Committee of Human Rights of the IAEA and the recommendations of the Special Rapporteur of the United Nations, that the member states respect the right of previous consultation and the right to be informed, that the program that the permanent forum recommended to the Mexican government with respect to recognition and strengthening community outreach police should be also implemented. That we avoid measures that favor international mining companies that infringe on the rights of indigenous peoples and violate our human rights. Indigenous communities are forcibly displaced from their original lands by racist and discriminatory police when often our rights to education, health care, and others are infringed upon, and certainly the Universal Declaration of the United Nations is flouted. We ask the permanent forum that it urge governments to take steps in order to improve our situation. Thank you very much.
Gracias a usted.
Thank you very much. We have had an extensive debate on this topic 7, future work, and item 4, human rights, and also item 3. I would like to thank you for this very important exchange of views and this dialogue that we have had amongst the delegates of indigenous peoples and member states in this permanent forum. We have come to the end of this session this afternoon. The permanent forum will have a half-day debate on indigenous peoples and forests. The next session, the 13th session will begin at 3 p.m. sharp. Now, before we adjourn, I'd like to give the floor to the Secretariat, which has some important announcements for us. Thank you.
Two announcements. The Global Caucus will meet this evening from 6:15 in the evening until 7:15 in the main cafeteria of the old building here at the UN. The Global Caucus will finalize its final statement at that meeting. The second announcement is that about the presentation and screening of the video documentary, The Ancient Heart. It is dedicated to the traditional knowledge of the native Europeans. There will be also speakers at that presentation, and it will happen on Wednesday, 28 April, today, at 1:30 to 2:45 p.m. at the Church Center of the United Nations. The address is 777 UN Plaza, 11th floor. Thank you.
The meeting is adjourned.